right, so for, well, I guess I would say it this way. A lot of today's message is going to sound more like one of our personal reflections than a sermon, but we'll get there. First, congratulations are in order for Josh Miles. In case you haven't heard, he was accepted into the Masters of Theology Studies program at Trinity Evangelical Church, or Trinity Divinity. just a pattern. Start again. Trinity Evangelical Divinity Seminary outside Chicago. So congratulations to him. He already completed his seminary degree here in Ardenny, so this will be a second one. So he'll start this fall, be a full-time online student, and it's a big turning point for Josh and hopefully for us as well. All right, so this past December, the producers of a Bible app called Dwell, maybe some of you might have heard of it, they offered their app at a discount, and it was like a Christmas special, and so I thought I would give it a try, and I ended up liking it quite a bit. One of its features is that it reads chapters of the Bible to you, and this is a pretty common thing with similar apps, but with this one, you just get lots and lots of options. You can choose from a variety of versions of the Bible and also a wide variety of narrators, and even choose the type of background music if you want any. And if you want, you can randomize all this as well, which is what I do. Take the Gospel of Matthew, for instance. You might have a guy with a slight English accent read chapter 1 out of the New Living Translation. And then chapter 2 might be another guy reading it out of the ESV with a slight Jamaican accent. And chapter 3 might be a woman reading out of the NIV with no particular accent, but her reading would be slightly dramatized, pulling you into the story. So there's just lots of options, lots of variety. And if you don't like one of the Bible versions or narrators, you can simply turn them off in the settings. And I turned off the version known as The Message, which is a pretty wild paraphrase, and also a guy named Mateo, who reads everything in Spanish. Not real helpful, since I don't know much Spanish. Now, at first, I did not think I would like this feature of randomizing the readings, but after giving it a try, well, it actually grew on me, and it comes with a timer. And so you can go to bed, and you can have it turn itself off after 15 or 30 minutes or whenever you choose. And I've been doing this quite a bit, about two or three nights a week since the beginning of the year when I've had trouble sleeping. I did it again last night, and I've been listening to the same book over and over and over. I've not drifted from this. It's always been the same book each night. And it's probably the last book anyone would ever want to go to sleep listening to. And that would be John's Revelation. And listening to it isn't necessarily restful. The first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down on the earth. A third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned up. And all the green grass was burned up. The second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turned into blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships sank and were destroyed. And the narrator goes on, reading about a third of the rivers turning bitter, and a third of the sun turning dark, and a third of the day losing its light, and so on. And then these soothing words: "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, because the trumpet blast about to be sounded by the other three angels." Some people go to sleep listening to recordings of the rain or the seashore or waterfalls. I listen to prophecies about the end of the world. On top of this, there are some bizarre and even disturbing images that can contribute to weird and troublesome dreams. If I am still awake at chapter 9, I am treated to an alarming and outlandish scene where the great abyss is opened up and thick, dark smoke rises out of it. And in that smoke are a swarm of locusts who look like horses prepared for battle. They have the faces of humans, the teeth of lions, breastplates of iron, and the stingers of scorpions. They torture the inhabitants of the earth for 5 months. People are in so much agony and pain that they long to die, try to die, but death eludes them. Yes, sweet dreams indeed. I like Revelation. In fact, if I were asked which book of the Bible is my favorite, well, as you all know, the correct answer, the expected answer is, why, all of them, of course. It's like asking which of your children is your favorite, you know? You have a favorite, but you would never dare say it. But if pressed, I would probably have to say Revelation. I have a special fondness for it. I liked it when I was growing up, even though I didn't understand it. I liked it after my conversion, even though I didn't understand it. I still like it today, and I still don't understand it. In fact, I came to like it a whole lot more once I stopped trying to understand it, or at least the hard parts of it. The reason I like it is because of the parts I do understand. And there are certain truths, themes, and concepts that Revelation has helped me to grasp in ways that, quite frankly, the didactic portions hasn't. Not everything, but some things. Certain things I know to be true have become more real in Revelation. And here is one example of that. The vivid and colorful drama of the Lamb being worshipped in chapter 5 is both beautiful and intense. There's nothing like it anywhere else in Scripture. Every verse is very rich. The same for the chapter before it, chapter 4, where the object of the worship is the one who sits on the throne. And there are several scenes in this book where worship in the throne room of heaven is described. Now, I have read scriptures on why God is worthy of worship. I've read the various commands on worshiping God. I've read examples in the Bible of righteous people worshiping him. I've even done word studies on the various words translated as worship. And all that has been beneficial. But nothing has impacted me like the worship scenes in this book, especially in chapters 4 and 5. And it's, quite frankly, it's just one of those things that's very hard to explain. When you try to explain it, and you end up sounding kind of silly. But it's just one of those things. And in a similar way, this book has been instrumental in helping me to appreciate God's majesty and power, and also God's justice and hatred for sin. And it has especially helped me to better appreciate Christ's victory and exaltation, this astounding fact that he rules and reigns over the universe as its risen and conquering king. Now, I've read and appreciate these truths when reading them elsewhere in the Bible, but the vivid images and colorful dramatizations in Revelation have helped me to grasp them, appreciate them, love them on a whole new level. Another example is the final state of those who belong to Christ. It wasn't until I studied this in the last chapters of Revelation that I actually got excited about it. If I were to speak frankly, up to then the whole thing seemed rather vague, I would say even boring. Playing harps in the clouds year after year, century after century, come on. The point is, I eventually came to see that there is more in Revelation than eschatology. Contrary to the stereotypical images about this book, there is more here than God unleashing his wrath upon the inhabitants of the earth for their rebellion. There is more here than the reign of the Antichrist and the oceans turning to blood and the rise of great armies and all-out rebellion toward God and his kingdom. There are other things going on, and these can be picked up if the book is read carefully. So today, as you have figured out by now, we are starting a series on this book, and that is actually my goal in this, pretty much more or less, to help us notice and appreciate a lot of these other themes and truths that help make this book of Revelation so rich. So this is not going to be a verse-by-verse exegetical or expository study. Nothing like that. It's going to be different than other books that we have tackled in the past. I'm not going to try to interpret the symbolism. Nothing like that. I'm not especially interested in speculating how any of the events described might portray events in the world, whether past, present, or future. Basically, I'm just going to talk about my own observations that I've made while reading this book over the years. And then the main part of this series, we'll spend some time looking at the warnings and exhortations to the seven churches that make up chapters 2 and 3. That's the main part. And indeed, a careful reading of the first chapter will show that the original audience this book was actually intended for was those seven churches, which may or may not be significant in understanding the book, but generally speaking, details like that can be quite helpful. So one more thing before we dive in, though I really like this book, it is at the same time, as we all know, very frustrating. Most of it seems, quite frankly, to be a big, confusing mess. John's vision seems like he was tripping out on LSD, okay? Not that I would know personally what a trip on LSD is like, but from what I've gathered from the movies, you know, it would seem like this would be what it would be. But, very important here, the reason a lot of it is so strange is because this seems to be what visions, at least in the Bible, are made of. Lots of bizarre scenes and images loaded with perplexing symbolism. Sometimes the symbolism is explained. We have examples of that in Revelation. But most of the time it isn't. And as we know, all sorts of people have taken the liberty on their own to explain the symbolism, resulting in thousands of different interpretations. And some of these can be quite a stretch. Anyone can make any verse say anything when it comes to this book. Not only is the symbolism difficult to decipher, but it is also difficult to know what is symbolic and what isn't. For instance, sometimes a sea, as in a body of water, will symbolize people, multitudes, and nations, as in chapter 17, where this is actually explained. And sometimes the sea is simply a sea, a body of water, as in chapter 7. And sometimes, well, it could go either way, and we just don't really know, as in chapter 12. Another question along this line, which details are intended to have symbolic meanings and which ones are simply there for dramatic effect? Take the angel from chapter 10 that comes down from heaven with a small scroll. It says that he was robed in a cloud. Try to visualize this. With a rainbow above his head, that his face was like the sun, and his shout like the roar of a lion. Well, do these details actually mean something, point to specific truths about that angel? Or are they there just to highlight the angel's splendor and the grandeur of that particular moment? Now, to get these and other answers about symbolism, we would typically consult commentaries, people smarter than us who have hopefully figured it all out. And for $35, we can have a piece of their wisdom. And there's no shortage of commentaries on the book of Revelation. There are so many because there is no general consensus on what the events we read about refer to, which brings to mind this. An early 20th century writer named Ambrose Bierce authored something called The Devil's Dictionary. I may have heard of it. Okay, it's a comical work where he has used satire to make light of certain words and definitions. And this is how he defined the last book of the Bible. Revelation, noun, a famous book in which St. John the Divine concealed all that he knew. The revealing is done by commentators who know nothing, right? And this was written over 100 years ago. Once Josh Miles finishes seminary, he will be qualified to take his own shot at it. He'll show us how COVID-19 and the war in Ukraine and barcodes and the rigged election and all fulfill prophecy spoken of in this book. I'll buy a copy. Probably won't read it, but I'll buy one. It'll look good in my library. The point is, much of this will remain a mystery to us. Nonetheless, Revelation deserves a place at the table. Though dark and terrifying and filled with doom and difficult to understand, it also has a beauty and wonder and mystery about it that really sets it apart. It vividly portrays the majesty and triumph and grandeur of God's holy will coming to pass. But unfortunately, as we know, many folks miss a lot of this because they get sidetracked trying to connect its prophecies to world events. Personally, I don't have a great love for most of eschatology, but I do love Revelation, and Revelation is more than eschatology. And my goal in this series, again, is that folks here will come to love Revelation as well, or at least love and appreciate it a little bit more. That's my goal. So for today, we're going to start by looking at the flow of the book, how it unfolds. It is, of course, somewhat like a drama, a play, if you will. It consists of a sequence of events, one following another in a very carefully planned succession. There are significant turning points in the action that we want to be aware of, know, and remember. And for all practical purposes, this action starts at the beginning of chapter 6. We don't really have that much action, so to speak, in the first five chapters. Chapter 1 is more or less an introduction that sets things up. Chapters 2 and 3 consist of warnings and exhortations given to the seven churches. And in chapters 4 and 5, we have a vision of the throne room in heaven. There are no plagues, no wars, no earthquakes, no tribulations, and so on. All those things start at the beginning of chapter 6 with a rider on a white horse and ends in chapter 19 with a rider on a white horse. So what we will be looking at here is not really an outline of the book, how it is structured. We will probably consider that in a week or two. My interest today is to simply track the action itself. And I have a couple reasons for doing this, which will become apparent here eventually. So hopefully you brought your Bibles, and if you want, you can follow with me as we do a quick survey of this chain of events, starting there at the beginning of chapter 6, where the first of seven seals is being opened. So everybody ready?
Yep.
Fasten your seatbelts. We've got some wild stuff ahead of us. In the opening of the first seal, there at the beginning of chapter 6, a conqueror rides out on a white horse bent on conquest. In the opening of the second seal, verse 3, a rider on a fiery red horse goes out to take peace from the earth, causing men to slay each other. In opening the third seal, verse 5, a rider on a black horse goes out to wreck the economy with hyperinflation. In verse 4, we're in it now, aren't we? Now see, I said I wouldn't do that. In opening the fourth seal, verse 7, a rider on a pale horse goes out to kill a fourth of the earth by sword, famine, plague, and wild beasts. So these are commonly referred to as the four horsemen of the apocalypse. In opening the fifth seal, verse 9, we see the faithful martyrs of Christ crying out for justice. They are assured that there will be justice, but in the meantime, more believers must be added to their number. In the opening of the sixth seal, verse 12, there is a great earthquake. The sun turns black, moon turns red, stars fall out of the sky, and mountains and islands are leveled. The inhabitants on the earth cry out for the mountains and rocks to fall on them and hide them from the wrath of the Lamb. After this, there seems to be a parenthesis of sorts, an interlude between the opening of the sixth and seventh seals. We have four angels stopping all the wind on the earth, preventing changes in the weather. We also have a reference to the 144,000 and a scene in the throne room of heaven. Though not entirely clear, these events do seem to be part of the sixth seal that had just been opened. The seventh seal is open at the beginning of chapter 8, and with it we find that it's a whole package in itself, consisting of seven angels with seven trumpets. And so the seventh seal is actually seven more judgments about to come upon the earth. So our attention now turns to the seven angels blowing those seven trumpets. When the first angel blows the first trumpet, verse 7 of chapter 8, a third of the earth is burned up, along with a third of the trees and a third of the grass. When the second angel blows the second trumpet, verse 8, a third of the sea turns blood. A third of the sea creatures die, and a third of the ships sink and are destroyed. With the third trumpet, verse 10, a third of the rivers and springs are poisoned, and those who drink from them die. Fourth trumpet, verse 12, a third of the sun, moon, and stars turn black, a third of each day becomes dark. At the beginning of chapter 9, the fifth trumpet is sounded and terrifying locusts are released out from the abyss to torture those who don't belong to God for 5 months. People will seek death, but death will elude them. When the sixth trumpet sounds, verse 13, four angels are released to slay a third of mankind. And this involves an invasion from the east, an army of 200 million. So like the interlude between the sixth and seventh seals, we have another interlude here between the sixth and seventh trumpets. And this involves chapter 10 and the first half of chapter 11. It largely consists of an angel interacting with John about seven thunders and about a small scroll that he is instructed to eat. And after this, we have the account of two witnesses, two prophets of God, who are hated and despised. And they are killed by a beast that comes up out of the abyss. But after 3.5 days, God restores them to life and takes them up to heaven. And this interlude, again, probably belongs to the sixth trumpet. They are events that transpire because the angel blew that trumpet. All right. And then in verse 15 of chapter 11, the seventh angel blows the seventh trumpet. And when he does, well, just lots of crazy things happen. Events that occupy chapters 11, 12, 13, and 14. It includes a dragon trying to consume a small child, a war in heaven where Michael and his angels battle the dragon, the rise of a ten-horned beast, commonly thought of as the Antichrist, and his reign over the whole world, which includes being worshipped. And this is followed by another scene involving the 144,000. Then three angels warning people not to take the mark of the beast, but to worship God instead. And this is followed by something referred to as the harvest of the earth. And this harvest is a manifestation of God's wrath, resulting in blood rising as high as a horse's bridle for 180 miles. When we get to chapter 15, we go from the seven trumpets to the seven bowls of wrath. And like the previous patterns, it appears that these seven bowls of wrath about to be poured out are the result of the seventh trumpet that was blown in chapter 11. So chapter 15 there describes a scene in heaven as things are being prepared for these seven plagues, the final acts of judgment to come upon the earth. When the first angel pours out his bowl, verse 1 of chapter 16, painful and ugly sores break out on those who have worshipped the beast. When the second bowl is poured out, in verse 3, the sea turns to blood and everything in it dies. When the third bowl, verse 4, is poured out, all the fresh water, rivers, and springs turns to blood. With the fourth bowl, verse 8, the sun flares up with intense heat, scorching people with fire. When the fifth angel pours out his bowl of wrath, verse 10, people gnaw their tongues in agony because of their painful sores. With the sixth bowl, verse 12, the Euphrates dries up and demonic spirits are released to gather kings for the day of battle. And finally, when the seventh bowl, verse 17, is poured out, the earth experiences its greatest earthquake ever, and huge hailstones, 100 pounds each, fall on the world's inhabitants. With many of these judgments throughout the book, we are told that instead of heeding the hardships as warnings, people curse God, blaspheme God, and refuse to repent. So here is what we have. Again, to summarize, the action starts in chapter 6 where the seven seals are open. With each one, some form of judgment visits the earth. When the seventh seal is open, it involves a whole new series of events, namely all the judgments from the angel sounding the seven trumpets. And when the seventh trumpet is sounded, it involves a whole new series of events, the pouring out of the seven bowls of wrath. So we have a succession of events, one sequence following another, and what we have here is something like a telescopic arrangement. Whenever the seventh of something happens, it gets real serious and involves a whole new series of really bad stuff. There is this sense that as we move through the chapters, things accelerate and intensify. But once God's wrath upon the earth is completed, with the last trumpet pouring out the last bowl of wrath, things after that take drastically a different direction. In chapter 17, the great prostitute is judged and overthrown. Babylon is judged and overthrown in chapter 18. The rider on the white horse comes with his armies from heaven in chapter 19. And the beast and false prophet are judged and overthrown. In chapter 20, we read about the thousand-year reign of Christ on earth. And finally, the devil is judged and overthrown. And then the death of death itself, when death and Hades are thrown into the lake of fire. And all of this then, this great purification, if you will, prepares for the new creation. The creation of the new heavens and new earth, as described in chapters 21 and 22. The book of Revelation, it's disturbing, it's dark, it's violent, it's filled with troublesome scenes, but there is a turning point when the forces of evil are beaten back, defeated, condemned, and destroyed. But again, everything is a succession of events. Everything that happens depends on something else happening before it, like the falling of dominoes. There is no new heavens and new earth until there is a great day of judgment, which follows the defeat of the beast and the devil, which follows the seven bowls of wrath, each poured out in a specific order, which follows the seven trumpets, each sounded in a specific order, which follows the seven seals, each opened in a specific order. And it all starts, all of this starts when the first of the seven seals is opened. When the first seal is opened, it sets off a chain of events that cannot be stopped. This is how things move. This is how the book flows. And somewhat interesting, whereas it is angels who pour out the bowls of wrath and angels who sound the trumpets, it is the Lamb who opens the seals there at the beginning. And he opens the seals because the scroll that is bound together by those seals has been handed to him. And that actually is the first action that starts this whole chain of events. Everything that transpires in Revelation, the judgments of God upon the earth, the ultimate defeat of the forces of evil, and the emerging of a new creation are all the result of this significant turning point. And it is described in chapter 5. The scene is so important that it is described in detail. Indeed, it deserves a whole chapter. Follow with me in verse 1 of chapter 5. Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. Verse 2. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. John says, "I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside." Then one of the elders said to me, "Well, do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. He had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He came, and he took the scroll from the right hand of him who sits on the throne. So let's finish out the chapter appreciating the response to the Lamb being worthy of this. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. They saw the significance and they sang a new song. "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals because you were slain. And with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." Then, John says, "I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. Try to picture this. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and in a loud voice they sang, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them singing, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." And the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. What a scene. Whatever the scroll is, we know that it comes from God. And we also know that whenever one of its seals is opened, it sets off a chain of events. History unfolds. God's plan, his will, rests on someone taking the scroll and opening those seals. But the scroll would only be given to someone who was worthy. And this explains why initially John wept when no one was found worthy. He understood just how crucial all of this was to the unfolding of God's plan for the purification and restoration of the universe. The scroll had to be taken. The seals had to be opened. The very thought of God's eternal plan of going unfulfilled, of being stuck, was beyond grief for him. But someone was worthy. Someone did come and take it. And from this chapter, we are told why he was worthy. He was worthy because, verse 9, he was slain, and with his blood he purchased for God men from every tribe, language, people, and nation. And he was worthy because, verse 5, he had triumphed. He had conquered. However, here there's nothing said about what it was that the Lamb had triumphed over, what it was that he had conquered. But it does tell us that earlier in the opening paragraphs of the book of Revelation. And it is assumed that what was said there is still in the mind of the reader. So let's flip back and look there. In Revelation chapter 1, starting in verse 12, we have here in his vision, John encountering the resurrected Christ. John writes, "I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet and with a golden sash around his chest. His head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all of its brilliance. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. Then he placed his right hand on me and said, 'Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades.'" He triumphed over that which no one had ever been able to triumph over before, ever. No one held under the power of death had ever been able to overcome it. No one has been able to escape its prison. The bars were too strong, the walls too thick, the keys too secured, the prison warden himself too powerful. Death enjoyed the reputation of being an indestructible fortress, but it could not hold Jesus. It cannot hold him because death has no power over the one who has never sinned. And so he was the one worthy to take the scroll from the hand of the one who sits on the throne. He was the one who triumphed. And he is the one worthy to be the Lord of history, the one who sets everything in motion, the one, the only one, who is worthy to set off a chain of events that will culminate in a great climax, the new heavens and the new earth in chapters 21 and 22. This because he rose from the dead and reigns over the universe as its risen king, as its risen and conquering king. So, the central figure in this book, as we read through it, we need to appreciate that it is not the beast or the Antichrist. It is not the dragon. It is not the two witnesses. It is not any of the mighty angels who blow trumpets. The central figure is not even John, who is seeing these visions and writing them down. The book begins with Jesus, ends with Jesus, and is centered on Jesus. He is the one who brings to completion God's perfect and holy will. The one who brings everything toward its final conclusion, the overturning of the curse and the restoration of Eden, a joy-filled eternity where God will be with us, we will see him, and we will serve him, reigning as priests and kings, as the last two chapters of Revelation describes. This because Jesus triumphed. This has to get into the DNA of our bones here. You know, I was dead, but behold, I am alive forever and ever. I am the living one, and I hold the keys to death and Hades. And this then brings us to something that Peter says, words that should be familiar. He was chosen before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last times for your sake. Through him you believe in God, who raised him from the dead and glorified him, so that your faith and hope are in God. Through him you believe in God, who raised him from the dead and glorified him. Your faith and hope, therefore, are in God. He was chosen before the creation of the world, his preexistence. He was revealed in these last times, his incarnation. He was raised from the dead, his resurrection and conquest over power and death. He was glorified by God, his exaltation to God's right hand, where he rules and reigns as the risen and conquering king of the universe. Indeed, this is the one we hope in. This is the one we have placed our faith in. This is the one we have surrendered to, the one who has saved us, sanctified us, redeemed us, reconciled us to God. This is the one who has promised us a joy-filled eternity. And this is the one we serve and worship and obey. And the one we honor and proclaim in our observance of the Lord's Supper. He is risen.
He is risen indeed.